Poverty not only affects mental health, as you'd expect, it's also bad for overall health. In the second segment of this week's installment of our series, Trapped, a look at poverty in America, we'll examine the ways that living in poverty affects cognitive development and health, especially for children. Joining us are Dr. Bernard Dreyer, professor of pediatrics at New York University School of Medicine, and Dr. Peter Munig, associate professor of health policy and management at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Bernard, what kinds of health and developmental problems are common among poor people, particularly children? What have you seen in your patients?
Well, I'm going to focus first on health and then look at development and sort of what I would call well-being outcomes. So regarding sort of straight health, we know there's increased infant mortality in the first couple of months and year of life. We know that there's a significantly increased low birth weight and subsequent health and development problems, increased frequency and severity of chronic diseases such as asthma, more food insecurity and poor nutrition and growth that's very associated with it. Generally poor access to quality health care, although in a state like New York, that's not the case because this state has done a good job of insuring children, but not every state has. And then increased accidental injury and mortality and increased obesity and its complications. So lots of health problems.
Are health issues and general well-being issues linked?
Well, to some degree they are. Obviously something like obesity affects your well-being, not only your health, but will affect your social development. Food insecurity causes stress and anxiety, so absolutely. Having a chronic disease affects your going to school. So health and well-being are very much linked. But I just want to emphasize that the early brain development is particularly vulnerable to the toxic effects of childhood. And we know that young children who are growing up in poverty have hear less words and speak less words, tremendously different amount of vocabulary. By the time they're 2.5 or 3 years of age, there are already huge gaps between poor children and non-poor children, and sometimes those gaps, most of the time those gaps are hard to catch up with. It's not impossible, but hard to change. We know that by the time poor children start school, they're 1 to 2 grades behind non-poor children. And, by the third grade, it's very hard for them to make it up. So that's going to lead to lifelong low educational attainment, often high school dropout, and other problems which will impact their economic and social future.
Well, in the United States, nearly 20% of children live at or below the poverty line. 10% live in deep poverty. Since
right.
That really has to do with their parents as well, should poverty among children be treated as a separate problem than general poverty?
Well, I think that some of the my answer as a pediatrician is yes. Of course, it's their family poverty that we need to focus on. So it's not that the child is poor by herself or himself. They're living in a poor family. But the reason I say yes is that if we're going to be putting resources into poverty, we certainly want to put those resources into families with children, especially, and families with young children, even more importantly.
Peter?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'd like to back that up a little bit. I mean, really, the most critical point in human development occurs basically from not long after conception through, say, age 8. And this is the time in which you can really intervene with social policies. So there's very recent, shout out to my own data there, a little between the two ferns, shout out. But I've looked at some of the early intervention programs and sort of went back and seen how they correspond to adult health. And some of these experiments were done in the 60s and 70s, where they basically experimentally assigned children to either early education or to a nutrition supplement or something very basic. And the kids that were treated with intensive early education, their IQs went up, and that seemed to have lasting effects throughout their life. They did better in school. They graduated at higher rates. And in the Perry preschool program intervention, at least, they were worth, the kids in the treated group over their lifetime were worth $1 million more than the ones that were not in the treated group. And this all sort of translated into better health.
So are you surprised by the fact that we're still going through a debate over whether pre-K is something that's valuable or not?
No, I'm not surprised at all. Part of the problem is that it's very difficult to translate good scientific research into social policy. So these experimental programs are very intensive. They are done under very controlled conditions and with very good management. And when you try to translate that into something like Head Start or Mayor de Blasio's initiative, really you need a lot of resources and you need good management to replicate these conditions. Head Start hasn't had nearly the same successes as any of these experimental programs.
Is poor health like... Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, so I would just... I mean, I agree completely, but I would add to that that... on the one hand, the word quality has to be used. So when we say universal preschool, we mean universal high-quality preschool. And so that's something this city, now that has $300 million to spend, needs to spend it on, not just preschool but high-quality preschool, because we know that's what makes the difference. On the other hand, to answer your first question, which am I surprised, I think I am surprised emotionally. I'm not surprised intellectually, because children don't vote, and poor families frequently who have young children don't vote as significantly. They certainly don't give large amounts of money to politicians. And so children, in fact, have been not completely neglected by our society, but comparatively neglected compared to the elderly who do vote and who do have large influential blocks. And so now poverty among the elderly, who used to be, you know, far poorer than children, are now far less poor. 9% of the elderly are living in poverty, whereas 22 or 23% of children live in poverty.
Is poor health likely to continue throughout one's life, even if a child raised in poverty rises out of poverty as an adult?
Well, you know, there's good research now that says even more than that, that childhood poverty causes long-standing health problems for adults, even if you control for how poor the adult is. So irrespective of how wealthy or poor you are as an adult, if you spend especially your early childhood or you know, your prenatal period poor, you're much more likely to have adult obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, et cetera. It may have impacts on your memory that are long-lasting and your ability to think. There are probably epigenetic changes that occur that give you lifelong risks for health problems such as cardiovascular disease.
I'm talking with Dr. Bernard Dreyer, professor of pediatrics at New York University School of Medicine, and Dr. Peter Munig, associate professor of health policy and management at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Peter, we just spoke with Dr. Jane Costello about how growing up in poverty affects mental health. Can you talk about how stress and psychological strain can affect physical health?
Yeah. So, you know, basically starting from not long after the point of conception, an embryo is exposed to a lot of different things differently in a poor mother and a wealthy mother.
Stress actually is transmitted to the embryo?
Yes, and it's not just stress, it's the byproducts of stress. So, you know, stressed moms are more likely to use drugs, to smoke cigarettes, things like that. And stress itself causes a lot of changes in the basic hormones and chemicals in your body, like cortisol. And those, as Bernard Dreyer sort of pointed out, can actually modify your genes in the way that they're expressed.
Well, wealthy people also experience stress in their daily lives. Does it have a different kind of impact on the fetus?
Yeah, you know, this is where things get really, really interesting, is that stress has different qualities according to different populations, and even poverty has different qualities by population. So, you know, I do a lot of research. I'm working on an experiment in China. I do a lot of research there. And, you know, amongst Chinese...
Mostly on boys, because they don't have as many girls these days.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this population is more urban and has more balance, but yeah, that's true. But in this population, even folks that are, you know, that are under the international threshold of poverty, under $2 a day, who are, you know, I've seen the houses people are living with, you know, vermin infestations and leaky roofs and all the things that we talk about associated with poverty here. People don't necessarily feel poor because it's more normative within this particular geographic region. And you don't see these same impacts. Like, you don't see a higher rate of asthma, for instance.
But as Bernard pointed out, and we learned from a Gallup poll just a few years ago, poor people tend to have poor health habits. They're more likely to smoke, less likely to have a healthy diet with five or more servings of fruit or vegetables a day. How does that contribute to poor health? And and among those Chinese people, I imagine the diet is even more.
It's much more stable in Chinese people. Actually, between wealthy and low income families. In the U.S., it's much more varied, with low income families eating much less healthy food. But it's interesting, if you look at experimental studies of non human primates, if you stress a primate. A mom in the lab experimentally, randomly stress her or not, or even a young primate, the less stressed primates will tend to make healthier food choices, and the more stressed ones will tend to make less healthy food choices. They're more likely to...
So that happens among chimpanzees and gorillas as well.
Yeah, it happens throughout the animal kingdom. And I think the Chinese case is a little bit different because there's really... a different psychological component to this poverty.
Bernard, you wanted to add to this?
I would just add that there's also in the United States, or in developed countries especially, the economics of food are very different. And so, you know, we talk about people being on food stamps. And, food stamps, you get $1.50 a day, $1.50 a meal for three meals a day. And think about... you know, using that amount of money to get your food. Well, the only thing you can probably afford is a dollar meal at McDonald's. And so you can't afford fresh fruits and vegetables.
They're
just too expensive.
That's not necessarily true.
I think that's an important issue here, that food insecurity and obesity are very much linked, although it seems counterintuitive. But the same kid who goes to bed hungry one day is going to eat high-calorie, poor nutritional food the next morning and, you know, become obese at the same time that they're actually poorly nourished and spending a lot of time being hungry.
Now, Peter, Bernard mentioned that in New York, the poor are more likely to get better health care than in many parts of the country.
Well, children, at least.
Children. But does Medicaid make a difference? Haven't some states resisted expanding Medicaid coverage as part of the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And the answer is we don't really know yet. health insurance programs like Medicaid do two things. One thing is that they allow you to get access to early treatment for conditions. Another thing that it does is it provides social insurance. It's a lot like a welfare program in that you're not going to spend your hard-earned dollars on, you know, ever-inflating health care. You'll have more money for food and things like that. So it's sort of a two-tiered approach. But when you actually look at the Medicaid experiment in Oregon or earlier health insurance experiments, it didn't really do that much for people's health. And the Oregon experiment is a sort of a recent famous thing that got a lot of media attention, where they randomly assigned people to a lottery, basically assigned people to Medicaid or to no coverage. And the reason we still don't know after that study is that they just enrolled too few people, probably.
Now, do we know whether a fair number of people below the poverty line have signed up for the Affordable Care Act?
Yes. The people below the poverty line got Medicaid expansion under ACA. So they got their coverage is expanding greatly. Yeah.
Bernard, is there a question?
The other thing, by the way, there is good evidence for children that getting health care has improved their health. And so I'm going to focus on the Child Health Insurance Program, which was for people slightly above Medicaid, that was adapted in the mid-90s and has insured many, many children. At, you know, right now, almost none of the children that I take care of, all of whom are poor, are uninsured, whereas at that point, 40% of the kids I saw were uninsured. We know all of those kids, their asthma is better, their immunization coverage is better. They're missing fewer days of school, so for kids, which are you know, by the way, healthcare for kids is very different than healthcare for adults, and the solutions are really somewhat different for both groups. Well, but we do know that health insurance for kids does give them access to things like care for their asthma, care for their immunizations, and other important kinds of health care.
Yeah, but we don't know for sure that that's making a difference. This is part of the problem is that the parents that are more likely to enroll in SCHIP are different from the parents that are less likely. So, you know, I think really until we get more data, and there is more data coming from Oregon, we won't know for sure.
Now, is the best way to improve the health of poor people to lift children out of poverty? I know there was an experiment done in the United Kingdom along those lines. What were the results of that?
Yeah, so there's two. There's actually quite a few different experiments that have been done at different points in the life course, and it actually makes more sense to sort of work backwards here, because before we had talked about how children are at a critical developmental stage and adults have already had sort of a lifetime of exposure to poverty. Actually, if you look at the experimental data from the negative income tax experiments in the 70s and welfare reform, we just recently relinked the welfare reform studies, two of them, to mortality data. And we actually found that welfare reform probably increased mortality amongst the people in the experiments that had time limits to their welfare relative to the people that could just
stay
on it.
This is the Clinton welfare reform.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there were lots of experiments that were done before that policy was enacted to see if it worked or not. And it did work to get people employed, but there's a subset of that population probably that couldn't get a job and suffered more, and as a result they had higher mortality. But these impacts are really, really small, whereas if you look at the experimental studies of poverty manipulation in China, in childhood, I've got China on my brain, then you see much larger impacts in adulthood.
I suspect that we're not going to resolve this problem on the show. Poverty has been with us since, I'm sure, people were living in caves. But let's hope that some people who actually can have a real impact have been listening to this conversation. My great thanks to both of you for being on our show. Dr. Peter Munig, Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, and Dr. Bernard Dreyer, Professor of Pediatrics at New York University School of Medicine. Thank you both.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.